the House Committee on Rules for Monday, February 17th, 2014. Welcome. And I would like to open a public hearing on House Bill 4027. So, Erin, could you please review the measure and the amendment?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 4027 transfers Oregon Art Commission from the Oregon Business Development Department. You have a -1 amendment. It transfers the Oregon Arts Commission to the Office of Secretary of State. We have no revenue, and we do not have a fiscal impact statement yet on the measure or the amendment.
Okay, I would like to call up Senator Beyer and Representative Chris Harker for testimony. Senator Beyer.
I forgot the other way.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lee Beyer, State Senator from District 6, which is Central Lynn and Lane Counties. Madam Chair, it's been a long time since I've been down in this room testifying. In fact, spent most of my time down here when I was in a house on that side of the dais on the Rules Committee.
Can you pull your mic just a little closer, please? Thank you.
It's the old mics. Madam Chair, I'm here in support of House Bill 4027, which deals with transferring the Cultural Trust and the Arts Commission from the Economic Development Department, or Business Oregon, back to the Secretary of State's office. And this goes back to, frankly, 2001, when I was in the Senate, and then Representative Ben Westland was in the House, and we got together with a bunch of Oregonians, and we came up with the Cultural Trust, the idea, and a structure. And part of that structure at that time, in terms of governance, was to have the trust housed in the Secretary of State's office. You might ask, why at that time did we suggest that? And the idea was that we wanted to have a statewide officer in charge of the arts thing, that have some support there for it at that period of time. And frankly, we looked at it and said, there's no way the governor, with all the duties that the governor has enough time to provide support to that institution. And that's the way it was originally passed. That's the way it came out the first time when we established the trust. After that, there were a few political issues that came along. Then Representative Westland had a few issues, involvement with it, and subsequently the legislature moved it to Business Oregon, where it has resided and is residing now. Last fall, there was a little issue of management there, and I don't want to go into that, but it raised the issue for me again. And frankly, my interest in this is I think we need to have a good, strong focus on the cultural side of issues. We spend a lot of time on others, and I don't think the director of Business Oregon has the time to focus on that area, although they do provide good support to it. But more importantly, while I think this is important, equally important is I don't want anything detracting from the Business Oregon's role of trying to build the state's economy. I just think they're not good fits. So the question is, where's a better fit? The logic behind Secretary of State's office, besides a good support of a statewide office holder, is the fact that we've got the archives there, and it's a place where they could do that. There's some issues of support in that, but I think none of that makes a lot of sense. The Trust and the Arts Commission have done a good job over the years. I think they will do a good job, continue to do a good job in the future, and I just think this is a better home for them, where they'll get a little more attention and have a little more focus.
Thank you. Representative Harker?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's always a challenge following you, Senator. Senator has made essentially every point that I was going to make, but I would like to echo a few of those. The Arts Commission is not about business. It is an extremely valuable institution, and the cultural trust that we have here in the state benefits people all over the state. I think that's one little bit of logic that can justify it being under a statewide officer. And Secretary of State does have substantive knowledge of Parks Commission issues, and in the interest of time, I won't say anything more right now.
Great. Thank you. Any questions? Representative Berger.
Thank you. Senator Byers, thank you. Couple of questions. One, what is the articulation or the connection between the Oregon Arts Commission and the Oregon Cultural Trust? Are they the same board? Are they one subservient to the other? Are they the same thing? And two, would then, under this change in legislation, allow the Secretary of State be the the decider of leadership positions within the Arts Commission, the Cultural Trust?
Actually, the Arts Commission preceded the Cultural Trust in statute and being created, and they have slightly different functions. My view of it was the trust, primarily what we were looking for in 2001 when we created the trust was a vehicle to move up the state's position in terms of public commitment to the arts. At that time, I was fond of saying that of the 54 states and U.S. territories, in terms of commitments to the arts, Oregon was 54th. I think we've moved up into the high 40s a little bit. But in fairness, we haven't gained as much as we hoped we would. Some of that is because of the primary funding strategies for the trust were three components. One was the sale of a designated state land.
Madam Chair, I don't think you understood my question. What is the relationship between the Oregon Arts Commission, which is the arts program, which is listed in your, and what is the arts program vis-a-vis this cultural trust? Is there?
Okay.
And then, who would have supervisory authority? In other words, the authority to hire and fire the director of whatever those programs are.
Okay.
They're real specific
thank
questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Berger. Right now, the authority to hire and fire, in both cases, resides with the director of the Business Oregon. Under this proposal, it's unspecified, but I assume that authority would shift to the Secretary of State, as the current one has authority over elections officers, the archives director,
okay.
And so forth.
That's an important question that I wanted on the record. And the arts program that is reading from this, administrator means administrator of the arts program of, you know, and commission mean the Oregon Arts Commission, and you may not be the one to answer this, but at some point I want to know how these things fit together, and our committee administrator can probably
Madam Chair,
out.
Representative, to my knowledge, and I stand to be corrected, I'm not intimately involved with it, haven't been for a while, but what has been the case is the executive director of the Arts Commission also provides staff direction to the Cultural Trust. That's how it has been, and I think the staffs supplement each other. It's not a huge organization. The difference, and it was confusing for me, I suppose it is to others, is the Arts Commission is fairly clear just the arts. Find out how you want, but it's just the arts. The Cultural Trust includes the arts as well as humanities, and I want to say historic preservation offices. That's one of the reasons we're trying to balance that, have been balancing that out. I frankly am not sure that you need two commissions, but that's what we have, and I'm not taking that one up at this point.
Thank you, Senator. I didn't put you on the spot, but I'm trying to figure out.
Perfectly fine.
Yes, Representative Kenema.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's my understanding that no one is scheduled to testify on behalf of the Cultural Advocacy Coalition. Are you familiar, excuse me, but if I could follow with the Senator, a question. I received an email from Christine Drazen with the Cultural Advocacy Coalition, and she said the CAC is not opposed to moving the Arts Commission and the Cultural Trust to another agency, but instead asking that the legislation be postponed for this short session to consider during the full 2015 session. We are initiating a statewide strategic planning discussion this spring and hope to bring an omnibus bill to the legislature in 2015. I hope you will be available to participate in the discussion, get in touch as more details are available. Are you familiar with this effort, and do you have a comment?
Madam Chair, Representative Kenmer, I've had a brief discussion with the folks, and they're a great organization of advocates, and they're calling, I think they call it the Big Think that they're planning to launch, and take a look in general at funding support for arts and cultural services statewide. I understand their position. I don't think the outcome of that really makes a difference on where these two commissions sat. You know, under whose authority, I think the goals that they're trying to achieve could be achieved regardless of where the administrator of the program sat.
Thank you.
And is it correct that no one from that organization has signed up to speak?
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Harker, Representative Kenmer, I do not have that particular person or if anybody signed up representing that particular group on my list. No.
Interesting. Okay. Thank you.
Anybody?
Okay. Any other questions? No? Thank you very much. We really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Okay. I am going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4027. We will come back to public testimony on this bill shortly. And I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 4071. Erin, can you please review the measure?
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4071 directs Oregon Historical Society to raise funds and commission statue of Mark Hatfield to be placed in National Statuary Hall in the United States Capitol. It directs the Oregon Historical Society to request Architect of Capitol to seek approval of Joint Committee on Library of Congress for replacement of statue of Jason Lee with statue of Mark Hatfield. The measure requires the President of the Senate and Speaker of the House and Representatives to activate a task force before task force members can be appointed for the consideration of future statute changes. There is a no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement was issued, and it is available on OLIS. And
I'd like to call up Representative Gilliam, Representative Williamson, and Kerry Timchuk.
Here.
Is Mr. Timchuk here? He is not. Okay, well then, Representative Gilliam and Williamson. One of you may start. Please identify yourself for the record.
I'm Jennifer Williamson. I represent House District 36, which is the west side of Portland. Many of you heard my floor speech last session about how Senator Mark Hatfield is one of my political mentors. It was working with him that I started down the path that landed me here and gave me the opportunity to serve the state that I love. When I was a freshman at the University of Oregon, proposed financial aid cuts to Pell Grants and work-study programs threatened to end my academic career when it had just started as the first person in my family to go to college. I didn't really know what to do when I got my financial aid letter, and it had pretty significant cuts in it. So I went to the head of financial aid and asked him what I should do, and he jokingly said, why don't you give Senator Hatfield a call, who at the time was chair of the Appropriations Committee. So I did, and the senator agreed to meet with a handful of students on campus, and at that meeting I went through my financial aid letter one line at a time and explained to the senator exactly what messages we were getting from what they were doing in Washington, D.C. After that meeting, he became an advocate for students and access to higher education in Oregon across the country, and I worked with him as a student through my my entire college career. In fact, I handed out an article that was written way back when I was in college in 1995 about that a lobby meeting that a group of students had with the senator in his office. And on the spot, in front of the reporter, the senator agreed, having not yet secured the resources or apparently not discussed with his staff, he agreed to put back all the cuts in the higher ed budget and financial aid that had been proposed. So we had quite an impact on him. He did it right there, and I heard from his staff later about how that was not the plan for the meeting. So after graduation, I went and worked for Senator Hatfield in Washington, D.C. My story is one of hundreds of stories just like individual Oregonians being impacted by the work of the senator over his 50 years of service. And now serving as in my first term as an elected official, I've become keenly aware of the lessons that the senator taught me both directly and through his actions. Most importantly, how to stay true to your values and vote your conscience. This trait made him difficult to classify politically. Just a few examples from his career that make him a very nuanced politician, an elected official. He was the only governor to vote against the resolution by the National Governors Conference supporting the Johnson administration's policy on the Vietnam War while pledging unqualified and complete support for the troops. At the time, the war was supported by 75% of the public and by his opponent in that November's election. He co-sponsored a nuclear freeze legislation with Senator Edward Kennedy, as well as co-authoring a book on the topic. And although a prominent evangelical Christian, he opposed government-sponsored school prayer and supported civil rights for communities of color and the LGBT community. Every corner of our beloved state has been shaped by the senator's 50 years of service, and as U.S. Senator, he directed billions of dollars in the form of federal appropriations projects to Oregon, including funding for transportation projects, environmental protection of wilderness areas and scenic rivers, education and research facilities, and healthcare facilities. In my district alone, I know that Portland State University and Oregon Health Sciences University would not be the institutions that are today, but for the senator's advocacy. So like our state, I've been greatly impacted because of my relationship with the senator, and I would not be sitting here today if I had not made that phone call my freshman year of college. So I urge your support of this bill. And I have to run away to go to my committee. So please excuse me.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Gilliam, please identify yourself for the record.
Vic Gilliam, State Representative from Silverton. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, and Representative McCoy. I cannot summarize in 3 minutes Mark Hatfield's place in Oregon's history, and I may not even be capable if I was given the time. So I will direct your attention to the little...
Excuse me, could you pull the mic a little closer to you? Some of the people are having difficulty hearing what you say.
Please. I'm not sure they want to.
Yes, we do.
I think some of them may disagree, but I think they do want to hear.
Thank you, Representative.
Sorry, put you on the spot.
So I wanted to call your attention to what was passed out. And I'm not going to ask you by a show of hands how you're going to vote this afternoon, but I am going to ask you by some sort of acknowledgement that you will read these later. And if you acknowledge that, I won't read them to you today. Okay, good. Madam Chair, in response to calling Kerry Timchuk, who could not be here, there is a letter from him on the cover. I thought these remarks by President Clinton when Senator Hatfield retired would be of interest. I also included what I think is a wonderful summary of why we should pass this bill by Jack Roberts, from our last session. You'll see that summarized there. I also think it's important when you look at all the different aspects of Mark Hatfield's contributions to the state of Oregon that we remember what he did for Native Americans, and that's why I included that sheet. So, as I mentioned, I don't know how you quickly tell someone about Mark Hatfield and his contributions to the state as a United States Senator for 30 years, being on the national stage and concerned about global hunger, as our governor. I remember a motto of his was paychecks and playgrounds, trying to find that sweet spot of using our natural resources and protecting our environment, as a member of both chambers of this building. So I will select a slice of what Mark Hatfield, I think, did for our state. And that is the last piece that I gave you. It's an opinion piece by Pat Wright. It was written in 1997. And again, I won't read it, but I urge you to take a look at it, because I don't think you'll ever find another more active senator who, on behalf of his state, understood the important natural resources and did as much as he did to protect them. So you'll see highlights there about Mount Jefferson, the vast number of acreage that he protected, the old growth in Opal Creek, other special areas. You'll see there Oregon Dunes and Hell's Canyon, Yaquina Head, Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area, Newberry Crater National Volcanic. And then this incredible number of rivers and streams that Representative Williamson alluded to that he protected. There has just been no more active senator, I don't think, ever, who protected as many important areas as he did, using, leveraging his positions on behalf of Oregon. There are other national environmental initiatives mentioned there that help the entire country. But, of course, I felt like the focus should be on Oregon. I don't think anybody should talk about Mark Hatfield without talking about the Northwest Power Act. I don't think we can underestimate what this coalition of senators, starting with Senator Hatfield and Senator Packwood, Senator Magnuson, and the fourth senator in Washington that escapes my brain right now, Scoop Jackson, did in saying, yes, we will share our incredible resource of hydropower, but not until Oregon's needs are satisfied first. It is one of our truly important levers in a good economy and in a contribution to this country and protecting of our natural resources. Now, to this bill, it's a little bit different than the one you saw last time. In addition to the nomination, if you will, of Senator Hatfield, it also includes a process going forward. I believe it respects the process and the arduous path that we've had so far in introducing this bill and what we've done to vet this bill. And it also respects the opinion that going forward there should be a process. And so it borrows from what we've done and codifies it. And I think you'll find it very interesting, both parts of the bill. In this new era, and that's what I'd like to think of this as, in this new era, when Congress in 2000 said, it's okay if you want to rotate statutes. The main provision is, if you bring a new one, it must remain there for 10 years. And that's all. A number of states have taken advantage of this. I think many more will. Two examples that are in my head are, first of all, California, of course, brought one home. They didn't boot somebody out of the Capitol. They brought one home, and they put a president of the United States there, Ronald Reagan. In another vein, Alabama brought a statue home. They didn't crush it or defile it. They brought it home, and they put Helen Keller in the Capitol. If Oregon does this, and I hope they do, there is nothing to say that the rotation could not continue. In 10 years, perhaps Mark Hatfield's statue would be brought home. Perhaps it would move to the side and someone else. But one of the things that I truly believe and am excited about in this new era and the opportunity that we have as a legislature is to showcase, to spotlight, not just make a statue that catches dust in some corner in the Capitol, but to showcase the very best of Oregon. I think we've already done that. I think we've done that with the two statues that are there. These two gentlemen that have been there for 50 years represent a great deal of Oregon history. And there's nothing in this bill to denigrate either one of those individuals. But now we have what I would call a modern pioneer, someone who I believe will inspire folks that come to see the statue, will show the very best of Oregon. And I don't think it would hurt us in a short session where nerves are getting a little bit raw, to put someone forward who saw the very best in the word compromise, who exemplified cooperation and integrity between parties, between individuals that disagreed. So that's just a little extra value added in this particular session if we move this bill forward. What would be sad is if we saw this as a competition. You know, our statutes and our lawmaking have they fluctuate and they have different points of view and things change. I heard that wonderful speech on the floor today about that. And I think we ought to be open to a new nominee. The only thing I would say from personal experience, because as you heard from Representative Williamson and others, there's nothing unique about having known Mark Hatfield, because he was in office for nearly 50 years. And I felt a very special relationship as a staff person. But believe me, it was not unique. But it would be very sad if we in any way saw this as a competition. If we denigrated any legacy of a person that's already there, specifically Reverend Lee or John McLaughlin. If we stooped to attacking them personally about their faith, to me that would be very sad. Because what we have are two wonderful legacies, and now the opportunity, the first time since Abraham Lincoln signed this bill into law, the first time, to put yet another statue where now millions of visitors go through the Capitol each year. This isn't just a few tours that wander around. The National Visitor Center is really quite impressive. And the opportunity that we have to showcase a person like Mark Hatfield, I think, is just an incredible opportunity. And I proudly bring this bill forward again, and I appreciate the chance to testify today, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Frederick, and understand we've got a really full agenda, so we appreciate you coming to testify. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. I'm Lou Frederick, a state representative for District 43 in the North and Northeast Portland. I will just say three different things. One is Mark Hatfield. I first met Mark Hatfield just after May 4th, 1970, as he allowed us to put backpacks and sleeping bags in his office in the Capitol following the Kent State situation. My college basically headed for that particular spot, and he was one of the senators who allowed us to use his office as a jumping off place to talk with our own senators. Secondly, I got a chance to meet him as a reporter back in the late 70s, where he was remarkable in terms of being very straightforward with me about helping me understand what was going on around the state, because I just arrived in Oregon, and one of the reasons I moved to Oregon was because of my interaction with Mark Hatfield in 1970. But really, I think it's important for my community, because Mark Hatfield was, in fact, one of the few people to step forward back in the early 50s, and you see that very obviously on the picture outside the House chambers. He was one of the first people to step forward, and the public accommodations bill is we have as a result of his work, something that was not necessarily applauded at the time by the powers that be in Portland or the powers that be in the state of Oregon. We are in Black History Month, and it is important to recognize that Mark Hatfield is a major part of what has taken place in terms of Black history in Oregon. So it would be a very good thing to be able to celebrate that and to show that kind of courage in the face of other problems during his time. So I would applaud this particular effort, and I hope we are able to do some kind of rotation regarding that. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Wait a minute. First, are there any questions from the committee? Okay. Now, thank you very much. All right. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4071. We will come back for additional public testimony. And I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 4144. Erin, can you please review the measure?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 4144 establishes Oregon Investment Department as public investment agency to be supervised, directed, appointed by Oregon Investment Council, specifies duties, functions, and powers of the Oregon Investment Department, transfer duties of state treasurer to investment officer to OID, establishes Oregon Investment Department Fund. This measure has an emergency clause on it. It has a revenue statement issued. It has a fiscal statement issued. This measure does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
With that, I'd like to call up Representative Reed, Representative McEwen, and Treasurer Ted Wheeler. Welcome.
sits down first, identify yourself, and start testifying.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm Tobias Reed from Beaverton. I recognize you have a very crowded agenda, so I'll attempt to be very quick. I think we're here to introduce House Bill 4144 to you, known as the Investment Modernization Act. We are excited about it because we think it brings Oregon's investment program into the 21st century. The structure that has served us so well till now is based on an understanding that was accurate and timely, perhaps in the 1970s, but things have gotten more sophisticated and more complex since then, and we think our structure should as well. The bill creates a model that emphasizes insourcing and allows for a newly created department to better align the responsibilities and authorities, creates much improved budget stability, and allows us to do a better job of managing the state's investments. The measure, I think, strikes the right balance between efficiency and oversight by the legislature, allows for the legislature to participate in the budget, but keeps the stability in place that allows for the department to hire the talent and capacity that will allow us to do a better job. Beyond that, we tried to keep the changes to a minimum. The length of the bill is largely a result of conforming amendments as opposed to substantive changes, but we commend it to you and hope you will support it, and I'll turn it over to Representative McEwen.
Chair Hoyle, Vice Chair Holvey, members of the committee, I am Katty McEwen. I represent House District 9 in the House of Representatives. This bill has wide-ranging benefits to the state's financial systems. The cost savings with Treasury projects that we can achieve are a net savings of 10 cents per year for every $100 that we invest, or over $80 million per year. The savings accrue to each fund invested. Pension fund savings would add up to a total of $2.8 billion over the 20-year horizon used to amortize unfunded actuarial liabilities. In governance improvements, this aligns the OIC responsibilities with authority to resource and staff the program for which they are liable, and gives the OIC the ability to properly and prudently manage investment risk. This measure has wide bipartisan support and support from a number of our very important stakeholder groups, which include the Association of Oregon Industries, the Oregon Business Association, the Oregon Business Council, the Service Employees International, and our local government depositors, the Association of Oregon Counties. Great. Treasurer Wheeler.
Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ted Wheeler. I'm the treasurer of the state of Oregon, and I'm very pleased to be here today to help introduce House Bill 4144 on behalf of the Oregon Investment Council, of which I'm a member, as well as the state treasury. I'll be joined in a few minutes by Deputy Treasurer Darren Bond, as well as Dick Solomon, who's the current chair of the Oregon Investment Council. I come today representing one of the top public funds in the United States. Collectively managed by the Oregon Investment Council and the Oregon Treasury, our $87 billion investment portfolio includes a number of funds. The most notable is the Oregon Public Employee Retirement Fund at $68 billion, but we also have a number of other funds, including the Higher Education Endowment Fund, the State Accident Insurance Fund, the Common School Fund, and many others. While our investment performance has been very strong, we believe we're at a pivotal moment today. There's more we can do to ensure that those returns remain strong over the long term and that we can better identify and manage the risk in today's global capital markets. The Investment Modernization Act is the kind of innovation that Oregon needs, and it's the kind of innovation for which Oregonians are clamoring. We'll do more, but spend less. We'll save over $20 million per year in the near term, and independent consultants have suggested that we could save in excess of $90 million over the long term as this program evolves. You don't need to be a math genius to do the basic math on this. This could potentially be a financial game changer for the state of Oregon. This bill represents an evolution of our investment operations that has been very well vetted. We were asked by the 2013 legislature to come back to you with a stronger bill, and this is the result. This proposal is the result of careful study and evaluation by the Treasury, the Oregon Investment Council, independent consultants and auditors who all looked at our current structure and compared it to industry best practices for large investment funds. We brought together diverse interests from all across the spectrum of politics to do something that we all agree will be better for Oregon and help strengthen our state. Local governments, business interests, representatives of the beneficiaries of our pension system all agree that it's time to move our investment operations into the 21st century. The Investment Modernization Act will not change what we invest in, but it will change how we invest, how we oversee those investments, how we improve and protect our assets from global market risk. It'll increase our accountability, and ultimately, we're all confident that we'll be in the best interest of Oregonians. As I've underscored, our investment returns do very well. Last year, the return on the Oregon Pension Fund was in excess of 15%, and it was ranked last year number one amongst its peers in the 1, 3, and 10-year periods. The Common School Fund, which supports public education in Oregon, topped 18%. So you may be asking, why do we need to do this at all? As the old saying goes, why fix what ain't broke? And the reason is because we can do much better. The returns that we've earned are not the whole story. Far from it. Oregon's investment costs are still very high compared to our peer funds, and the staffing that we have in place to identify and manage risk in the portfolio is very short compared to other states. Let me give you one example. The state of Wisconsin has a fund very similar to ours in terms of the size and in terms of the kinds of investments they make, yet they have 6 times more investment professionals managing their portfolio than we do in Oregon, and their overall investment costs are half that of the state of Oregon. I could tell you a similar story about our portfolio versus that of the state of Washington. House Bill 4144 will reestablish the Oregon Investment Council as a public investment agency, move the investment division under a reestablished Oregon Investment Council, and insource significant back office operations for which we now pay top dollar to outsource to other states. The treasurer will remain the only elected member of the Oregon Investment Council. It's worth noting that almost 40 years ago, a different state treasurer, Bob Straub, testified before committees much like this in an effort to lead a reform effort that faced significant headwinds at the time, but for which we now all agree, in retrospect, was visionary. Straub took us from fixed income investments into equity stock investments. Obviously, that worked out well for us, but the fact remains we have effectively the same management structure in place today and the same procedures. Things have changed remarkably since the times of Bob Straub's, and we must innovate as he did and rise to meet the challenges of today and beyond. Treasurer Straub was responsible for a portfolio that was $750 billion. Today, our portfolio is 100 times larger. It's global. It has more international exposure. The kinds of investments we're engaged in are more complex. The information flow in the markets is much faster. And, of course, technology has radically changed the way we manage investments. It's time for Oregon to evolve and prepare ourselves for the future, and we cannot afford to wait. The risks aren't going away, and we can start saving millions as soon as this bill is enacted. As treasurer, I am confident that this bill represents the best path forward from the state's investment operation perspective. I want to close by publicly thanking the many individuals and organizations that worked with us to make this a strong model. We've been told that this Oregon innovation will again be a national model for our peers across the country. Specifically, I want to thank legislators from both parties, particularly those who are here today, supporting this bill, the Oregon Investment Council, SEIU, the Oregon Business Association, Associated Oregon Industries, the Oregon Business Council, Paul Cleary of PERS, and so many others who've worked hard to help shape this bill. I also want to personally thank each of you individually for your support of an innovation that will serve Oregon families for decades to come. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee on this particular bill? Sure. Yes, Representative Holvey.
Thanks. So one question that kind of pops up when I was just going through the bill, it seems that we're creating a new state agency with the Oregon Investment Council to some degree, if not totally. And most agencies go through the budgeting process through the legislature to get their budget approved and their expenditure authority approved. But I don't see that in this framework.
Chair Hoyle, Representative Holvey, members of the committee. First of all, in answer to the first part of the question, while the bill does create the Oregon Investment Agency, it is really a reestablishment of an existing function. That's the Oregon Investment Council. What's happening is the investment division is being realigned underneath the Oregon Investment Council and will report directly to the Investment Council through an executive director. So there's no new bureaucracy or anything like that being created. It's a realignment of the resources that currently exist. And I'm sorry, I forgot the second part of your question.
That part I'm completely, I guess, fine with. It's just the expenditure authority not being subject to the legislature's approval or oversight.
Correct. Chair Hoyle, Representative Holvey, members of the committee, we actually have had conversations with members of the Ways and Means Committee, and one of the modifications that we've agreed to in this bill is to report our budget to legislative leadership, to the Ways and Means Committee, 30 days prior to the budget being adopted by the Oregon Investment Council, and we've agreed that that 30 days will be during a legislative session. So you, the Ways and Means Committee, the media, and the public will all have an opportunity to weigh in on that budget.
Follow up?
Yes.
So in terms of the legislature weighing in, would they have the authority to not approve of the budget or the spending authority?
Representative Hoyle, Representative Holvey, members of the committee, what you are creating here is an agency that has its own budgetary authority but with accountability. Since it's a statutory arrangement, you could, in theory, pull the entire operation back. But what we're trying to overcome here is a budget process which, for us, shoehorns us into an organizational structure and procedures that mandate, in fact, that we outsource a great deal of functions that other states and other funds have actually been able to insource. And we're not talking the more complex positions on Wall Street around private equity or real estate. We're talking basic back office operations like fund accountants, auditors, and analysts, where I know that we have people here in the state of Oregon who are qualified to fill those positions, can do them as well or better than the people on Wall Street, and we can do it at a much lower cost. So we're weighing different opportunities here. We believe we've kept the accountability and the public transparency in place. In exchange for that, we're getting $2.8 billion in cost savings over a period of 20 years, if you amortize.
Good.
Anyone else? Okay, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. I want to call up Darren Bond and Dick Solomon from the Oregon Investment Council and the Treasurer's Office.
Chair Hoyle, may I stay for the testimony?
You may. Thank you. I'm just going to remind people that we have a lot of bills, so if you could be succinct, and if you have something in writing, we will have read it. Or we will read it. So with that, please identify yourself for the record.
Chair Hoyle and committee members, for the record, I'm Dick Solomon. I'm speaking in my capacity as the chair of the Oregon Investment Council. Since 2004, I've served on the OIC as a volunteer citizen member, and that has given me a unique perspective on Oregon's investment portfolios in both good markets and bad. Briefly, there are three reasons the Oregon Investment Council unanimously supports passage of HB 4144. First, improved governance. The bill will correct a major deficiency in our organization structure. Currently, the council is responsible for investment of over 80 billion dollars, but the staff is hired by and responsible to only one of our members, the state treasurer. In my experience, we've had honest and conscientious treasurers, but that may not always be the case. Good practice requires that the council have authority over those we task with implementing our policies. Reason two, reduced costs. Because of our limited staff, we heavily rely on Wall Street investment managers. With proper staffing levels, we estimate that outside management fees could be reduced by as much as $2.8 billion over 20 years. Reason three, greater controls. The council strongly believes we need to increase our risk management analysis and compliance functions. Best practices mandate beefing up our controls to avoid costly and embarrassing mistakes. Thank you.
I'm just here if the questions get technical.
Any technical questions? Okay, with that, thank you. Oh, yes. Representative Berger. We have three more people. We're going to close it shortly.
Let me just say to the treasurer, I am a co-signer on this bill. There's a lot of questions here. This is a big, complicated thing, but I really applaud you for coming forward to
try and look at this a different way. This is an important thing that we as a state certainly need to be looking at this kinds of... I don't get it all, but I thank you for bringing this forward and looking at this. I think the future is before us, and I think you've nailed it. We have to start doing things a different way in Oregon with this big of investment, so thank you all.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks. You are excused. With that, may I like to call up Rob Bavette, DJ Voigt, and Rob Sisk. Identify yourself for the record. And
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rob Bavette. I'm legal counsel for the Association of Oregon Counties. I will be very brief. AOC, my client, has thoroughly vetted this proposal in a series of meetings, and the treasurer's office was very kind to loan us their senior staff to talk about all the details. We had lots of questions, and at this time, we are convinced that this is the direction that Oregon needs to head, and so we support this bill.
Madam Chair, for the members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rob Sisk, president of SEIU 503, OPEU. SEIU Local 503 supports House Bill 4144, which will improve the quality of services at the Oregon Investment Council. More than 20,000 of our 55,000 members have their pension funds managed by the Oregon Investment Council. The legislation makes it easier for the OIC to bring in-house contracted services that cost the investment funds managed by OIC tens of millions of dollars per year. This will bring work back to Oregon that is now being performed by Wall Street consultants for a very steep price. An outside review of OIC indicated that bringing risk management in-house would bring OIC into line with other states. The investment fund is well managed, but this is one area that needs improvement. The savings are estimated at $23 million a year and are expected to grow over time. These efficiencies over the course of 20 years would reduce the unfunded pension liability by $2.8 billion without reducing workers' benefits. The proposed amendments enhance the capacity of elected officials to oversee the new Oregon Investment Department. We are very pleased that the bill's oversight provisions have been strengthened from the 2013 version of the bill in some very important ways. It is important to our union that the legislature continues to have strong oversight of government functions like those performed by the Oregon Investment Council and the department. Unless legislators are satisfied that the oversight is strong enough, we would have serious reservations about the bill. The underlying concept behind this bill is important enough to put in the time and effort this session on the improvements on oversight. This is the sort of innovative reform that Oregon needs, and we look forward to working with the Oregon Investment Council, the Treasurer, and the Legislature to ensure the new model has legislative accountability, public oversight, and necessary flexibility. We urge the committee to adopt the upcoming amendments, tighten the oversight, and pass the bill.
Good afternoon, Chair Hoyle, Vice Chair Holvey, members of the committee.
For the record, my name is DJ Vogt. I'm Vice President of Government Affairs for the Oregon Business Association. And we are here today in support of House Bill 4144. I just want to hit a couple points, and I'll take a management structure perspective on this. From our members' experience, it shows that a risk management function is particularly best provided in-house, assuming it can be resourced appropriately. Any manager of $90 billion needs a model that an organization of such a scale would use. It makes more sense to provide this in-house than paying outside consultants, which are much, much more expensive. Important point to note that others have hit, but I'll hit it as well. The legislature is not ceding all authority to the OIC. It's giving the OIC the ability to structure and staff the investment division to be more efficient and effective. Now, in short, the OBA supports giving the Treasury's investment division a modern management model that it deserves so it can continue to provide the world-class returns to its funds that it has been doing in the past several years. Thank you.
Questions from the committee of this panel? You're free to go. We're going to close public hearing on House Bill 4144 and open a public hearing on, or reopen a public hearing on House Bill 4027. And if we could get Greg Fitzgerald, Bob Speltz, good afternoon, gentlemen. Welcome to the Rules Committee. If you'd introduce yourself for the record before you give your testimony.
Representative Holvey, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Bob Speltz. For the record, I am the chair of the board of the Oregon Cultural Trust, and I'm here to talk to you today about House Bill 4027. As you've heard already, 4027, if enacted, would move both the Oregon Arts Commission and the Oregon Cultural Trust out of Business Oregon to another, as of yet, undesignated agency in state government. While the boards of the Arts Commission and the Cultural Trust have not taken a formal position on this bill, I would like to share my personal perspectives with you and update you on some planning activities that have been taking place over the last year. Very briefly, my primary message here today is that as advisory boards, we serve as advisors on policy matters that help fulfill the vision and mission of the Cultural Trust and the Arts Commission, which includes increasing access to and participation in culture for all Oregonians. As advisory boards, we also study existing policies and make recommendations for change and implementation, basically by staff. I want to be clear that our boards are not opposed to making changes that would improve the overall effectiveness, the efficiency, or the impact of the organizations. However, we have not had the time, nor the opportunity, to develop strategies that would allow us to maintain our successful work while undertaking a significant move from one department. Over the past year, our boards have been working diligently with staff to make a number of important changes that we believe are improving the overall effectiveness, efficiency, and the impact of our organizations. Relocating the organizations has been among the ideas suggested, but it has not been seriously considered or studied by our boards or staff. I would urge you today to resist the temptation to relocate these organizations and instead allow our boards and other key stakeholders to continue a deliberate planning process already underway that, as you heard previously, will result in a package of changes we hope to bring to you in the 2015 session. As you heard previously, in April, the Cultural Advocacy Coalition is going to convene a large gathering, nicknamed the Big Think, with leaders from the philanthropic and cultural community, businesses, policymakers, and others who are interested in revitalized rural communities and vibrant urban centers, arts education, and a strong creative economy. These leaders will be invited to come together and respond to the question, what role should the state play in supporting and advancing Oregon's cultural life? That statewide conversation is going to begin in April, and we'll begin with a comprehensive look at Oregon's current cultural efforts. We'll review available research and study and do a thorough examination of best practices in comparable states across the nation. Recommendations from the strategic planning discussions will be opened up to further comment and review by county cultural coalitions, statewide boards, legislators, and other stakeholders, all prior to the 2015 session. Finally, before I close, I do want to say thank you again to the legislature, who in the previous session renewed Oregon's cultural tax credit. Because of that tax credit, Oregonians contributed a record $4.1 million in the last calendar year to the trust. We had our best year effort, so thank you for that, making that possible. I appreciate the chance to be here with you all today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Speltz, so that $4.1 million, what percentage increase over the last year were those donations?
Well, my recollection is between 3 and 4% increase from the previous calendar year.
So was that, did that live up to your expectations? I know that the stock market was up 30%, that many nonprofits had significantly more donations. Do you have any understanding why it stayed basically stable? I mean, it increased, which was good, but why it stayed stable?
Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, I think a number of things factored into the success. We had a very fruitful, productive partnership with the Give Guide, a Portland-based alternative newspaper that raises several hundred thousand dollars, particularly by donors under the age of 35. I would say I personally was very pleased to see a 4% increase. The trust has been raising about $3.9 million for the last 3 or 4 years, so we were very happy to get over the $4 million mark. And we had a good year, not unlike other nonprofits in the state, which had good fundraising years as well.
But the other nonprofits tended to have a much better year. So was that 3 or 4%, or I thought it was around between 2 and 3% increase, did that meet your expectations, exceed your expectations, or was it below your expectations?
Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, it exceeded expectations for me.
Okay.
I can point to other organizations that had larger increases, but I was pleased.
Thank you for your work, and I really appreciate the work that the Cultural Trust does. I think it's an important organization, and it has a great impact throughout the state. What I, and I think others, want to ensure is that the Cultural Trust and the Arts Commission is in a place where that has the bandwidth to really focus on preserving our cultural heritage and supporting the arts, again, throughout the state in rural and urban areas. So thank you for that. Any other questions? And then Mr. Fitzgerald, please identify yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is Greg Fitzgerald. I'm from Eugene. Madam Chair, distinguished committee members, I appreciate this opportunity to speak with you today. I'm a director of the Cultural Trust, and I'm here to speak in favor of Bill 4027. I am speaking as an individual today and not on behalf representing a position of the trust, because as Bob says, the trust itself has not formally taken a position. Because I was not in Oregon when the trust and the Arts Commission were created, I don't know the rationale for putting them under Business Oregon. But with more than 40 years of boardroom and executive management experience, I do know that there are major problems with the trust and the commission: strategic problems, management problems, and board governance problems. From a strategic perspective, it makes no sense to keep the Trust and the Arts Commission under the Business Oregon umbrella. Business Oregon's mission is to help create and grow for-profit businesses. That mission is antithetical to giving charitable grants to non-business cultural organizations that have an entirely different purpose. And by law, they cannot be for-profit. This is a strategic misfit of the first order. The Trust and Arts Commission have never received the attention and support they need to be truly effective showcase organizations for the people of Oregon. They are small, neglected activities inside Business Oregon. Just look at the Business Oregon website. Neither the trust nor the commission are described on the opening page. I think it's very revealing that Business Oregon's mission statement never even mentions art and culture. After trumpeting their business mission, there's an afterthought two paragraphs later that says, Business Oregon also houses the Oregon Arts Commission and the Oregon Cultural Trust. It's as if they're talking about an unwanted child. It's clear to me that the Trust and the Arts Commission are and always will be orphans as long as they're in Business Oregon. But sadly, the problems are more than just neglect. Business Oregon appears to operate through the state's rules as though the state's rules and policies don't apply to them. This came to light with the firing of the Trust's executive director. Now, I want to make it clear that I am not here to talk about the merits of that decision. It's Business Oregon's right to terminate an employee, and I have no problem with that. But there is a problem in how it was done. The Journal Statesman's Journal reported on December 18th, Business Oregon did not follow the state's procedures in its firing of the Oregon Arts Commission executive director. The state's human resource policies clearly require agencies give managers annual performance reviews. Its policies also lay out a procedure for disciplining managers in any way, including firing them, which involves a formal investigation and a hearing with the employees. McCabe's department followed none of those procedures, and I close quote. While this is not my responsibility, it sure should be yours. If your government departments won't follow the rules, why should anyone? I want to describe the very serious governance issues I've encountered as the director of the Cultural Trust. When the governor appointed me and I proudly took my oath of office, I agreed to uphold my duties and responsibilities as a director. These are detailed in the governor's membership handbook for boards and commissions and the attorney general's very, very excellent book, A Guide to Nonprofit Board Service in Oregon. I am deeply concerned about a lack of proper board governance in general and a number of specific matters, including what appears to be non-disclosure of material information to the board, misleading information given to the board, no authority for a director's actions, and no board notice or approval of such actions. I have asked four times for information about these matters, and four times Business Oregon has refused. I've submitted copies of my correspondence with Business Oregon as part of my testimony. These emails provide the details of my questions, especially my letter dated November 16th. The breaking point occurred January 31st, when Mr. McCabe emailed me saying, the department is henceforth treating your request for information as a public records request, and that I must from now on go through his PR person. I want to stress that I am asking for information to which I am legally entitled as a director. This is not a journalist request. The Attorney General in his handbook says, directors have a right to any information they need. And here I quote, when a problem exists, a director has a duty. It changes from right to duty to inquire into the surrounding facts and circumstances. This is the crux of the problem. I'm trying to do my sworn duty to find out what happened, and Business Oregon is stonewalling. I believe the problems I've described demonstrate conclusively that it's time to move the Cultural Trust and the Arts Commission. Give them a home where they will thrive with proper care, management, and governance. I think there's a good strategic fit with the Secretary of State, and I would support that move. As I conclude, let me say that over the last 40 years, I have been a senior executive at major publicly held corporations, and I have served on many for-profit and not-for-profit boards. I have never encountered such neglect and disregard for proper board governance. You can fix these problems by approving House Bill 4027. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer your questions.
Yes, Representative Berger.
Mr. Fitzgerald, I appreciate I have not had a time to read your packet.
It came in late.
But I am... just for the record, less convinced that this move would change the issues which you describe. Putting it in another agency doesn't necessarily solve the problems that you have encountered. Just, I would like that on the record. That I see the problem statement you're putting. I'm not sure that this bill is the answer. But thank you, and thank you for your work, because I know it has been tireless, and you've been this before this legislature before, and you are always forceful, cogent, and get to it right away, and I appreciate your thoughts.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Fitzgerald, I really appreciate your testimony. I was unaware of the specific problem that you got to it toward the end of your testimony. I don't have your background or experience with for-profit and non-profit boards, although I've had some, and I completely agree with you that it's utterly inappropriate for information to be withheld from a member of a board of directors who's from the organization that he's the board in, that is supposed to allow that board member to carry out his official duties. I would respectfully disagree with my colleague, Representative Berger. I think that moving this agency to the Secretary of State's office actually would improve at least that aspect of things, since the Secretary of State has a complete business records and registration division that works with these issues regularly and would not make that kind of mistake. I appreciate that.
Representative Kenneman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions. First, of the committee, are we going to hear anyone from the Secretary of State speaking to this issue?
Not today. And we're not moving it, just so that everyone
knows.
You're
not going to be moving this
today.
We're not
moving
this today.
That's
helpful information.
We do not have the fiscal back.
Okay.
And we will get, we've requested a fiscal that both covers what it would cost to move the Arts Commission and Cultural Trust out of the state lands building and what it would cost if it stayed there. Because ostensibly, there really may be no reason to physically move these agencies, just to change who has oversight. So we're going to have that information tomorrow.
Okay. And then follow-up question, please.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Fitzgerald, are you familiar with these efforts to evaluate a better location by the Cultural Advocacy Coalition, and do you have an opinion? If you,
as a matter of fact, I do.
Thank you.
I was a member of the Cultural Advocacy Coalition, and my term was coming up. I disagreed with their approach to delay on this, and they advised me that they were not going to renominate me to the board.
Okay.
So, yes, I am familiar with it. And
okay, that's clear. Thank you.
And? I told you he was direct.
Yeah, and would you beat around the bush a little further, please?
I think what they're trying to investigate is very worthy. And calling it the big think, in fact, is probably truth in labeling, because it is looking at many, many elements, going back in part to when the original idea was that the trust would have a $200 million endowment based on land sales, which never happened, that maybe it's time to find other funding sources. There's lots of things that can be thought about big time. But the administrative staff issues that we're talking about now, one, if you let this continue, you perpetuate a bad situation for another year. You have a strategic misfit inside Business Oregon that is never going to be fixed so long as it's there.
Yeah.
And where my position on this is, go ahead and make the administrative changes where I think you, in fact, will get more involved leadership. You will address some of these problems now that we have encountered by making a move. And then, having made that move to something where I think it makes a lot of sense to be in the Secretary of State, one of the things there is they don't compete with another program that is much bigger, more interesting, and more fun than the Commission and the Trust. Secondly, they have auditing capability, and one of the things that the staff of both these units needs is the ability to follow up the performance of the grants. So the staff of the auditing department can help train and support the staff. And third, if you look at the archives and look at the arts, the culture, the humanities today, they create tomorrow's archives. So by being in the Secretary of State, you build a continuity with a sensitivity to the historical record, to the arts, and to the culture, and to the humanity of this state. So that's why I think it belongs there, and I believe it belongs there now, because you will fix, in my judgment, some of these administrative staff problems that are largely neglect of leadership. And so that's why I think we could have it.
Great. Representative Kenema?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up, and I appreciate the forthrightness. I guess I also would like, if we're going to have another hearing, to have the Secretary of State or somebody respond about to some of these issues and the issue of fit. They have an enormous number of duties, and it sounds like this is would require some active oversight and involvement, and I guess I'd like some assurance that we're not just making it a change. I'd like to make sure if we're going to make a change that there's not only a reason, but there's going to be a change in outcome. So,
if you would. And not to belabor the point, but my questions have not, to my satisfaction, been answered between the articulation of the Arts Commission and the cultural trust and the ways and means process and what we put into those. And all of those questions are things that I would like to get on the record at some point. Thank you. And they don't have to answer it now because I know your time is short.
Yes. I want to thank you very much for coming up and speaking to this. And thank you. Okay, we have one more person on this bill, and Mike Marsh. Is he here? Not here. Okay. Well, with that, so I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4027. And I am going to open a work session on House Bill 4110. Erin, can you please review the measure and the amendment?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4110 comes to you from your House Health Care Committee. The measure prohibits insurer from denying reimbursement under health benefit plan for covered services provided to pre-adjudicated person in custody of county sheriff, requires insurer to reimburse county sheriff for covered services at no less than out-of-network provider rate. You have a -A4 amendment, which establishes approval for biosimilar product to be approved through the second Food and Drug Administration approval process. I believe you also now have a -A5 amendment. The -A5 amendment prohibits discrimination based on age, expected length of life, present or predicted disability, degree of medical dependency, or quality of life in issuance of health benefit plans and in determination of medical services covered by state medical insurance assistance program. Applies to health benefit plans in force on January 2nd, 2015. You have a -A6 amendment, which does several things. It requires Cover Oregon to make results of independent audit public on their website. It ends Oregon's involvement in it ends Oregon's state-based insurance exchange, requests waiver to allow access to federal subsidies, and it moves elected officials into the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange Program. You have an A7 amendment, which just includes the piece about the audit for Cover Oregon. I believe we received an A8 amendment right before the hearing started. The A8 amendment requires the executive director of the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange to appear before House Committee on Healthcare and the Senate Committee on Healthcare prior to March 9, 2014 to present an updated business plan for the future of the health insurance exchange.
So this is what happens when you have a bill relating to health care.
That modest clause, yes.
So with that, we are not going to discuss the underlying bill that was thoroughly vetted in the health care committee.
Thank you.
With, you know, I think general support, but there was discussion on both sides on that piece. So we're here to discuss the amendments because there was not time to discuss or entertain amendments before the deadline for the health care committee, which is why we're entertaining them now. Representative Conger would like the opportunity to speak to the amendments that he would like to potentially be introduced.
Thank you, Chair Hoyle, colleagues, Jason Conger, representing House District 54.
I'm a member of the Health Care Committee, so I'm familiar with this bill and also with most of the amendments, but not all. So the ones I thought I would speak to quickly include the A5, the A6, the A7, and the A8 amendments. So dash 5 through dash 8. Madam Chair, I don't know if you want to have me sit through if there's a motion for any of these and then talk about it when the motion's before you, or you just want me to describe them quickly. I'm happy to do either.
Right. Representative Schenemer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question, and I guess I was guilty of not listening carefully enough. I think we have scheduled a work session. Are we in a work session, or is this a hearing?
Work session.
It is work session. Okay.
It is
thank
work
you.
Session. Yes.
You don't have to have a motion. You can discuss
I think just discuss the amendments and in general.
Fantastic. So I'll actually start with the A6 then. And this is a kind of a roll-up of several amendments that we were trying to get before the Health Care Committee. Other members of the Health Care Committee who are here tonight are already probably at least passingly familiar with them. The first would require legislators to enroll through Cover Oregon should Cover Oregon continue to be the way that private insurance is obtained. So it'd be prospective. The second has to do with transparency, and we know that there's at least one independent review of Cover Oregon going on right now. It's my understanding that the way that investigation or the contract with a third party to conduct that investigation is structured, a lot of that information could be redacted. When the report comes out, when the findings of the investigation are complete. And so the idea for the second part of the A6 is to have transparency and try to restore some public trust by disclosing all of the investigations, audits, et cetera, and being more overtly open with the public and with the legislature. So this, I think, is a very good amendment. We also, in the dash 6s and separately in the dash 7s, conduct the performance audit of Cover Oregon after 12 months instead of 24. So it's just accelerating the Secretary of State's audit process. Again, given the situation with Cover Oregon, we don't need to talk about that. We're all familiar with it. It'd be great to move forward with a performance audit a little bit quicker. And then the last, which is my favorite part of the dash 6s, is an amendment to terminate Cover Oregon and request allow people who qualify for the tax subsidies under the federal law, under Obamacare, to apply to be eligible for those tax subsidies when they purchase directly from insurers. So taking out the Cover Oregon middleman effectively, and it's an ineffective middleman, at least so far, if I may say so. That would also reduce the cost, by the way, for consumers. Currently, I think it's 5% of their premium. Actually, I should say it's a charge of 5% of their premium gets paid to Cover Oregon. So they're actually paying 5% more for their health insurance than they would be otherwise. So this would be a way just to reduce the cost, just like that, with the wave of a pen. And a couple of votes, which I'm counting on. That was the dash 6s. That's by far the longest. The dash 7s I already mentioned is accelerating the transparency amendment, standing alone, to reveal results of investigations and audits of Cover Oregon publicly and to the legislature without redaction or without restriction. The A8s, and then I'll go back to the A5s. The A8s require the director of Cover Oregon to come before the House and Senate Health Care Committees and report before the end of session on a certain list of information that I think is incredibly important for us in both in the Health Care Committees and the legislature more broadly to understand where Cover Oregon is at. So it includes things like having an updated business plan so that we can know that there's at least some expectation that Cover Oregon will become self-sustaining as was originally intended, but also demographic information about people who are enrolling. We've been requesting that repeatedly.
We've been told it's not available at this point. At some point, we need to know who's enrolling and if they're representing the population broadly or if they're all sick, high-risk folks, you know, who many of us expect are probably the ones who will be the quickest to enroll and maybe the only ones to enroll. So the A5 is completely different. It's not one, I think, that we heard in the healthcare committee, but it prohibits discrimination in treatment and in coverage based on age, expected length of life, disability, degree of medical dependency, quality of life issues. This is a, actually, I think it's consistent with federal law. I can't say that for sure, but I'll put it on the record that I believe that's the case. This would true us up with federal law, which has an anti-discrimination provision in it. But it would also apply to state medical assistance programs. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Kenemer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the courtesy of having these discussed. Are we going to have an opportunity to consider whether or not we want to include these in the bill?
We will have that opportunity if somebody makes a motion.
Okay. Would now be appropriate time?
Sure, now would be appropriate.
Okay. Madam Chair, I would move the adoption of the A5 amendments to House Bill 4010A.
Okay.
4110.
Thank you. Representative Kenemer moves to adopt the -5 amendments to House Bill 4110. Is there...
And they're dated February 17th, 2014.
Right.
That's another piece of the record that needs to be
okay.
there.
Sorry.
Sorry, I overlooked
dated
it.
Dated February 17th, 2014. Is there any discussion? Will the clerk call the roll?
We already had explanation, and I don't see need to do it.
Will the clerk call the roll?
Representative Barmer?
No.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Parker?
No.
Representative Jensen?
No.
Representative Kenemer?
Aye.
Representative Smith-Moore?
No.
Vice Chair Hicks?
Excused.
Vice Chair Holby?
No.
Chair Boyle?
No. Having not received the required votes, the amendment is not adopted. Okay. The next. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. Madam Chair, I would move the -6 amendments to House Bill 4110A, dated 2014.
Representative Kenemer moves to adopt the -6 amendments to House Bill 4110. Is there any discussion? Will the clerk call the roll?
Representative Barnhart?
No.
Representative Berger?
Yes.
Representative Parker?
No.
Representative Jensen?
No.
Representative Kenemer?
Aye.
Representative Smith-Warner?
No.
Vice Chair Hicks?
Excused.
Vice Chair Holby?
No.
Chair Boyle?
No. Okay, having not received the required votes, the amendment is not adopted.
Yes.
Thank you. Appreciate your indulgence. I'd move the adoption of the A7 amendment dated 2017-2014 to House Bill 4110A.
Representative Kenemer moves to adopt the -7 amendments to dated February 17, 2014, to House Bill 4110. Is there any discussion? Will the clerk call the roll?
Representative Barnhart?
No.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Parker?
No.
Representative Jensen?
No.
Representative Kenemer?
Aye.
Representative Smith-Warner?
No.
Vice Chair Hicks?
Excused.
Vice Chair Holby?
No.
Chair Boyle?
No. Okay, having not received the required votes, the amendment is not adopted. And final? Yes.
Thank you.
Chair, appreciate the courtesy. Final one is I'd like to move the adoption of the A-8 amendments and I don't know, are they dated today?
Today.
Also today,
yes.
Then, February 17th, 2014, to House Bill 4110A.
Okay, Representative Kenmore moves to adopt the A8 amendments dated February 17th, 2014 to House Bill 4110. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, may I comment? If this one goes down also, I'd like to move on to the -9 through -20 amendments.
The chair does not recognize that request. Is there any discussion? Will the clerk call the roll?
Representative Barnhart?
Madam Chair, this is on the -8.
Eight.
My vote is no.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Parker?
No.
Representative Jensen?
No.
He said no.
Representative Kenner?
Aye.
Representative Smith Warren?
No.
Vice Chair Hicks?
Excused.
Oh, he's excused.
Vice Chair Holby?
No.
Chair Hoyce?
No. Having not received the required votes, the amendment is not adopted. Okay, with that, and thank you very much, and thank you, Representative Conger.
Thank you, committee members, for your patience. Thanks.
With that, we're...
Representative Jensen.
Yes, Representative Jensen.
I'd like to move to the ag forwards.
Well, first, we're going to have some testimony on those.
Can you go ahead and move them?
So, can we move them?
He can move them.
Sure, he can make a motion. Yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead.
All right. Representative Jensen has...
Move the dash
fours. Okay. So, what do I do? Representative Jensen moves to adopt the -4 amendment to House Bill 4110, dated February 17th, 2014. Is there any discussion? And within that piece, I'm going to bring up some people to speak for and against the bill.
Let's hear them first.
Yes, what we'll do.
Thank you.
So first panel is Fawn Berry and Cindy Lombacher. I hope I pronounced your name correctly.
I'll go first. Great. Thank you. Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Fawn Berry, and I'm representing Mylan, Inc. Mylan is a leading U.S.-based manufacturer of generic and specialty medications. We're here today to oppose the -4 amendments, which include language related to biosimilars. I've submitted a document to you that lists several other organizations that are also in opposition to the -4 amendments. The issue of biosimilars and biologics is extremely complicated. It was brought to the legislature for the first time in 2013. And during that time, proponents and opponents worked on Senate Bill 460, which ultimately passed. We had lengthy discussions about this issue. We were able to negotiate a compromise in Senate Bill 460 that allows for the substitution of biosimilars for biologics. The legislation also includes doctor notification provision, which Mylan and those in our coalition opposed. The reason that we allowed for this measure to move forward is that we also had an agreement that this issue would not be brought up in the 2014 session. We also had a provision that sunset that portion of the legislation in 2015. Because of these reasons, we were disappointed to see the -4 amendments. We were not anticipating them in this short session, and we do not believe that now is the time to discuss this issue when it hasn't been fully vetted. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Hoyle and members, my name is Cindy Lobacher. I'm with Express Scripts. Express Scripts is one of the nation's largest pharmacy benefit management companies. We're here today in opposition to the -4 amendment. In addition to Ms. Berry's testimony, I wanted to add that the problem we have with this bill in part is we just saw the amendments late this morning. It appears to define insulin as a biologic and generic insulin as a biosimilar. We haven't had a chance to fully evaluate the implications, but are concerned about the potential cost implications of doing this for both patients and our plan sponsors. In 2012, nearly 500,000 prescriptions for insulin were dispensed to patients in the state of Oregon. As such, we request that this issue be tabled until such time that the language can be more fully vetted as to the cost implications of requiring prescriber notification for insulin for thousands of patients. Finally, and more importantly, there's no urgency to this. Insulin is currently defined by federal law as a drug, much like your cholesterol meds, high blood pressure, et cetera. In 2020, that will change, and the federal law will adjust for regulatory purposes and define insulin as a biologic. But until that time, we think it's inappropriate to get ahead of the federal the change provided by the federal government. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? From the committee.
One question.
Yes.
You didn't see the amendment until today. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, that is correct. I was made aware of the amendments around 11 o'clock this morning.
I thought the amendments were out on the 14th.
Why did these amendments come in?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I received them on Friday. We posted an agenda with this bill on it this morning and subsequently posted the amendment shortly thereafter the agenda was posted with the measure on it.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Yep.
We're going to hear from the proponents of the
yes,
amendment
we
as
will.
Well. Thank you.
After this. Okay. Thank you very much. With that, I will call up Nate Miles and Hasina Squires.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Hasina Squires. I'm here today on behalf of Eli Lilly. With me today is my client, Nate Miles, who is the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives, State Government Affairs. I affectionately refer to him as Nate, and for those of you who have met him, you will too. We are here today in support of the Dash 4 amendments. I'd like to make a clarifying statement about when amendments were released. In the House Health Care Committee, there was a Dash 2 amendment that was circulated many days prior to Friday. Those amendments were not as narrow as we had expected them to be crafted. Therefore, we went back and made some revisions to them to further narrow the scope, and that is what you have today before you is the Dash 4 amendments. We are supporting this amendment because we believe that we know that there are two different pathways for biosimilars to receive FDA approval. In the bill that was passed last legislative session, Senate Bill 460, only one of those pathways was inserted into the statute. This language would simply insert the other pathway whereby those types of drugs could receive FDA approval, with the overarching policy continuing to be and no policy decision FDA approval would be required for these types of drugs. Just both pathways would be recognized under the statute. With that, I'd like to turn it over to my client, Nate.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ladies and gentlemen of the committee, thank you for your time today. And as Hasina said... Nate Miles with Eli Lilly and Company. And as Hasina said, this really is kind of a technical change just to make sure currently that they're listed in the statute was one pathway through the FDA by which the biologics could be approved. And there actually is a second pathway that we just want to make sure is referenced so that when this goes through the pathway 355, as it's referred to, is recognized as well. One of the things I like to say is it used to be if you wanted to get from Portland to Salem, you'd get on the old highway and you'd go up and down. It might have been slower, so they put in a freeway. And so now if they ask you, how do you get to Salem, you say you go on I-5. Well, you can still use the old highway, too. It may take you longer, but they are both pathways to get you there. And so we just wanted to make sure that both of those pathways are listed in the bill. And so what you have before you in the amendment is that just clarifying that both pathways are FDA approved to be for the approval of biologics.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. It sounds like the proponents and the opponents are talking about different amendments. I don't understand how these two sets of ideas hook together, and maybe it's because I don't understand what this two-pathway thing is about. I will tell you this is an issue of first impression for me. I don't believe I've ever seen a reference to 42 USC before. And I'd like to understand why it makes any difference whether Oregon law references one or two pathways concerning the behavior of a federal agency, and please be specific to this case, for this situation. Just to finish the question, I think the federal government is going to do what it does, regardless of what Oregon's statute says.
In fact, currently under federal law, the biologics are approved under two different statutes. One is the Federal Food and Drug and Cosmetic Act. The second is the Public Health Services Act. Recent legislation, the Biologics Price Competition and Innovation, established a regulatory pathway for approval of these biosimilars, which applies only to the Public Health Services Act. However, there is also a regulatory pathway through the FDCA for biologics, and that was the 355. And so what happens here is because of the bill that was passed last year, it references these acts, and it only referenced the one. We wanted to make sure that it referenced the two. In fact, in the year 2020, they're going to take and merge both of these so that they are just all of the same pathways. But several medications had already started the process. We, Lilly, make one insulin that has started down that pathway, and there's another one called Omnitrope, which is a human growth hormone that's not ours, that has started down that pathway. So everything will come together in 2020. But because there was a piece of legislation that passed here last year that referenced it, we just wanted to make sure technically that it says both of those pathways are out there and that both of them fall underneath this law that was passed last year.
Follow-up, if I may. Could you tell us where you came from in order to testify today?
Oh, just from Seattle.
Thank you. And follow-up, if I may. Thank you. The opponents of this measure say that the point of the measure is to require that in the future a special approval has to be obtained from a doctor in order to use a different medication than the insulin made by your company. Is that one of the effects of this amendment, or have they misstated it somehow?
This doesn't impact anything that was already done with regards to that last year. All this does is just adds the pathway by which we're going through. This does, and if you look at the amendment,
Did you understand my question?
Yes.
Okay. The question was their claim is that this amendment will require an additional step to substitute a different medication, namely the specific approval of a physician, in order to prescribe a different medication than your medication in certain cases. What you're talking about doesn't sound like it's connected to that at all. I'm trying to understand whether or not the claim that they're making is true or not. That's what I'm trying to understand. And you're not answering that part of the question. That's what I'm interested in.
I think that the claim that they make, I don't know if they knew what we have in the pipeline, which is one of the reasons why they may have made the claim, but I can just tell you that we have a medication in the pipeline that comes underneath that, and that all we're doing in here in this part of the with this amendment is just adding to the pathway that was included in the bill last year the different pathway. This, if you look at the piece of legislation, we didn't ask for anything new other than to have that second pathway defined in the amendment.
Madam Chair, if I may follow up.
Yes.
Thank you. So I take it by your answer that you're not denying the statement made by the opponents. Is that correct?
No, what I'm saying is if they're saying that our bill, if the amendment does something that it's not, I don't know where they would see that add in here, because the only thing that our statement is that our amendment is doing is attempting to add a second pathway that was left out of this the bill that went through last year.
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, if I can further clarify, this amendment...
It's not clear at all yet, so
okay.
Please go ahead.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart. If I can further clarify, by adding this second pathway into the statute, we would be then subjecting ourselves to all of the other provisions in Senate Bill 460. If we were FDA approved, if this drug or other drugs under this pathway were FDA approved, just like all of the existing drugs that are in the current statute, that pathway, that physician notification, and all of the other requirements that were outlined in Senate Bill 460, we would also have to comply with all of that. We would become part of that bill.
Could I follow up then? Actually, this is a slightly different topic. I think you may have said that Lilly is working on other drugs that would have the effect of extending your patent, or similar drugs that would lead to a new patent to provide similar kinds of drug effects. Did I understand you correctly to be saying that?
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, at no time have we reported to be having a discussion about additional patents, extending of patents, or any of that type of...
Well, but he did say that he was talking about additional pathways to deal with new drugs, and so that was a reasonable conclusion on my part. I simply want to clarify.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I've been informed by Lilly Legal Counsel that we have one drug that is following the old pathway that is not in the statute, that would be added to the statute by virtue of the Dash 4 Amendment 1.
And if I could follow up on that, could you tell me what drug are we talking about, and what's it for?
It is a new insulin glargine product that we have.
Yes. Thank you. That's what I thought we were talking about. Appreciate it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Barnett.
Representative Holby.
Thank you. I was trying to understand these different pathways. Are both these pathways currently, approved by the federal government currently?
Mm-hmm.
And what you're saying is the state of Oregon passed legislation that only referenced one pathway?
That's all. So this would just include the second one.
Okay. Are there any further questions or discussion? Okay, then we have a motion. Representative Gents.
Madam Chair, could I move for a recess?
Yes. Yep. Okay.
order.
Long story, I'll tell you.
We have a motion on the table.
To adopt the 84s.
Representative, we have a motion on the table to adopt the Dash 4 amendments dated February 17, 2014. To House Bill 4110. Discussion? Yes.
Madam Chair, I have voted to amend this bill, affirmatively to amend this bill three times before. I will be affirmatively voting again to amend this bill, but reserve my right to vote against the bill after amendment.
I understand.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else? Yes, Representative Jensen.
Madam Chair, I see some nervousness about moving the bill or not moving the bill today. I would be comfortable if you wish to withdraw my motion, or I would be comfortable to hold it over pending your judgment.
We will vote on the amendment, and we will... We will not vote on the bill until tomorrow.
Okay.
So, with that, I'll have the clerk call the roll.
Representative Barnhart?
Excused.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Kenner?
Aye.
Representative Smith Warner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hicks?
Excused.
Vice Chair Holby?
Aye.
Chair
Boyle? Aye. All right. The amendment is adopted. All right. With that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 4110. Can we record his vote?
We can open the work session and so they can maybe get them over to our
You might ask him if he wants to first.
And the rules so you can vote? Okay. Okay. All right. With that, I'm going to open up a work session on 4144, which is the Treasurer's Bill. Never mind. I'm just reading.
This is where you say Vice Chair Holby.
All right.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4144 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. The measure be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Holby moves House Bill 4144 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the measure be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion passes. All right, I'm going to close that work session. And now I know that many of you have been waiting, so I very much appreciate it. And we have public hearing on House Bill 4071. With that, we're going to have a timer so that we can get as many people up as possible. Committee was meant to end at 4:45, but I want to make sure that people get heard because you came here to be heard, and that's vitally important. So we'll have a 2-minute time limit, and we will accept written testimony for anything that you would like to have us read. With that, I will call up Aaron Auer, Kimberly Auer, and Byron Auer. Please identify yourself for the record, and after you do that, we'll start the timer.
Okay. My name is Byron Auer, and I came from five generations of born Oregonians, and I am opposing the bill 4071 on the removal of the Jason Lee statue. And I'd like to give my time to my son, Aaron Auer, if I possibly could, Chairman.
Sure.
Thank you. And stated for the record here, Aaron Donald Lauer, founder and president of Roar Ministries, Reviving Oregon's Amazing Roots. And I believe there are several other people here to testify that are willing to waive their time as well. And this being such an important issue, if we could just have enough time to not go through all of this, but just a few minutes to make sure that we can cover enough in response to that is my request. So I started out this ministry here April 16, 2007, a rally at the Capitol, about 2,000 Russian people. And I discovered the statue of Jason Lee with Bible and petition in hand. And because of that statue, these treasures are here today. Authenticity, authority, without question, if it's irrefutable, that Oregon's founding father is Jason Lee. Today is President's Day, and if we were to remove the statue of Jason Lee in comparison, that's removing the heritage of our founding father, George Washington, because Jason Lee is the George Washington of Oregon. I want to open up with a quote from, when I speak here as a witness, I want to speak of the former witnesses of Oregon, one being the governor, T.T. Geer. He has a book, 50 Years in Oregon, and here's a sentence here that he said. He said, "The history of Oregon will be searched in vain for a more pathetic story of individual experience than that which clusters around the career of Jason Lee." What he's stating is, it's vain to search anyone else to compare who Jason Lee was. Because the scripture is clear, Proverbs 22:28, "Remove not the ancient landmark which thy fathers have set." And so he goes on to say, in speaking of Jason Lee, "Furthermore, it should not only be a part of our everyday knowledge, the heritage of our state and what he did, of our grown people." We're grown people here today. This must be everyday knowledge. "But should be included in the curriculum of our schools. The man or woman who would be assured of the solidity of a structure, either material or governmental, should take a deep interest in the manner in which the workman proceeded with the construction of its foundation." And Jason Lee, with his wife and other associates, wrought mightily in the laying of the cornerstone of our present state government and advanced industrial development. So the seats of government that we all may sit in, by appointment or elected, is because of Jason Lee's being the cornerstone of our present state government. How can we remove that? Well, no reasonable person would. We have other things here. When they dedicated the life-size portrait of Jason Lee in the House of Representatives, where that beautiful mural is of Joe Meek, who's for a divide, you see. Well, when they hung that and unveiled it, Governor Olcott of the day, he said this, "Unhesitantly, I say," this was 1920, "unhesitantly, I say that Jason Lee was Oregon's most heroic figure."
So, Mr. Auer, you've got double time, and your time is up. So how would you like to handle that?
Could I request there's some other people that are on the list to testify?
I think if two people will cede their time, you could have four more minutes, and then that needs to be it. Because we actually, this committee was due to end at 5:45, and there's a number of us that have other commitments to go to. And
we're talking about our
thank you.
We're talking about our heritage here.
Right, and we did hear your testimony previously, which and you had testified very well before, so most of us were here to hear that testimony, and you're also welcome to submit something in writing.
Yes,
4 minutes.
Which we have. So 4 minutes starting right now?
Right now.
Wow, thank you very much. God bless you for that. We have here an address by Mr. Scott of the Oregonian. Years passed here when Jason Lee's remains were removed here. 1906, here's what he said. On this view of our missionaries in Oregon rises to proportions more and more majestic as we study it from the standpoint of history and of consequences. And though others have bore lofty spirits and did great work, including Mark Hatfield, no name stands or will stand above that as Jason Lee. We have the authority here. This is when they dedicated the statues in Statuary Hall on our birthday of the state, 1953. And here, look at this. And I'm going to submit this to the committee here as well. On October 26th, the 1920 oil painting of Jason Lee was presented to the state of Oregon. By the way, that burnt down in the Capitol burning in 1935, and thankfully we have the American flag there that was recovered from it. The portrait was done by Mr. Vesper George of Boston, Massachusetts. It goes on. It hung there until it was destroyed on that day. The portrait was presented by Thomas A. McBride, Justice, Oregon State Supreme Court. He said in part, "The precious jewel of a commonwealth, the one thing above all others which it should treasure, is the memory of those grand and self-sacrificing men and women who laid the foundations of its greatness and prosperity. One of these treasured memories is the life and work of Jason Lee, the founder of American civilization in Oregon. Lee combined the fervor of a missionary, the foresight of a seer, and the patriotism of a loyal citizen." We have record over and over and over again, overwhelming. This is not about, to me, honoring anyone. We can give honor in a lot of ways to a lot of people. But to replace our heritage, Jason Lee statue in Statuary Hall, has been there 61 years here, represents not just all Oregonians, but Oregon, Washington, Idaho, the whole Pacific Northwest, the old Oregon country. And he is a national treasure to the United States of America. If you remove his statue, you're taking it from America, his rightful place, with an identity theft of our heritage. This is not about honoring Mark Hatfield. Regardless of how wonderful people are, we must preserve our heritage. And we do know this is something to consider of Bible in hand and petition, meaning he's petitioning for statehood that won the Oregon country to the United States more than anybody. And we have overwhelming evidence and record of that. Petitioning with the Book of Heaven that the natives sought after, that someone will testify what they did for the Book of Heaven. So to have the Bible in hand, it's a national treasure, and there is a movement around the United States to replace our heritage of our founding fathers, including Jason Lee, the preaching statesman. So I bless you today in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ to do the right thing, not just for you and us Oregonians, but honoring the past, yes, the present, and the future people. This is so important that we do the right thing, and the Lord will bless our state in honoring Jason Lee. God bless you.
Thank you, Mr. Auer.
Thank you.
Mrs. Auer, and just identify yourself for the record, please.
Yes, Madam Chair, Hoyle. And the committee, thank you for listening to this testimony. I wanted to do this in so many ways. I wanted to present myself as Anne Marie Pittman, who was married to Jason Lee, and I wanted to read a poem on what she wrote that the Lord gave her to write to give to her husband when he was traveling 6 months on horseback over land and over the mountains for this state to be a state today. And I thought that it would be appropriate, too, to be able to read it and just to have a little bit of a breakup of all the other stuff that goes on in this room, to have something poetic read. And I would just ask that you would just open your hearts and listen to this mighty woman of faith who loved her husband so much. And if she was alive today, she would say, "What are you doing? Why are you doing this? My husband did this for you, and you're going to remove his statue? You're going to remove his representation to the nation?" That's what she would say if she was alive. This is what she wrote, her poem. Now remember, they were only married 8 months, and she was pregnant with her child. "Must my dear companion leave me, sad and lonely, here to dwell? If 'tis duty thus that calls thee, shall I keep thee? No, farewell. Though my heart aches while I bid thee thus farewell. Go thou, loved one. God go with thee to protect and save from harm. Though thou dost remove far from me, thou art safe beneath that arm. Go in peace then. Let thy soul feel no alarm. Go thy Savior with. Will go. Thy Savior will go with thee. All thy footsteps to attend. Thou you may feel anxious for me. Thine and mine he will defend. Fear not, husband. Go thy father is and friend. Rocks and mountains may divide us. Streams of water too will flow. Time to me will seem most tedious. And the hours will move too slow. Thus divided, oh, what cares my heart will know. Go and seek for fellow laborers. Tell them that the field is white. God will show them many favors while they teach the sons of night. Bid them hasten here to bring the gospel light. Though thy journey may seem dreary, while removed from here, from her your love, though you often may feel weary, look from comfort from above. God will bless you and thy journey prosper, prove. Farewell, husband. While you leave me, tears of sorrow oft will flow. Day and night will I pray for thee. While through dangers you go, oh, remember her who loves you much. Adieu." That was Anna Marie Lee.
Thank you so much for that testimony and for reading that beautiful poem.
A minute.
Actually, your time is well over. If you have one closing sentence.
Okay.
Sentence.
In July 1946, the Oregon Statuary Committee had all the children in Oregon in the public school donate $1,473.68 to the Jason Lee statue. We don't need to bring Jason Lee back here. We already have him on our state capitol grounds. We need him where he is to represent the labors and the giving of the wives and all those women who prayed for their husbands for this journey.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Yeah. Sam Wegner, Marilyn Shannon, and Kathleen Robison. Robison? Yourself. Just identify yourself for the record, please.
My name is Kathleen Robison. I am Montana Blackfoot. As you see, I wore my regalia today in honor of Jason Lee. He brought the Book of Heaven to our people here, and he brought so much to Oregon. He brought union between our people and his. He brought territory, and it grew. His roots go so deep. But first, I would like to read White Swan's words of Jason Lee, if that's okay. White Swan, chief of Yakima, in the address before the Methodist Congress held in Portland during Lewis and Clark Expedition 1905. "If you ask me a question, have you seen Jason Lee, the first missionary? I answer, yes, I saw him. Some ask, how old are you, White Swan? I answer, I am 86. I was old enough to understand everything, and this missionary, he baptized me at that time. And from this time, I joined the church camp meeting at Waskopam, the Dalles.
When he started to work, he sent Indians from place to place to ask other Indians to come camp meeting, and all the different tribes came. Then he buy dry salmon and other things for camp meeting and put them on tent 40 feet or more. That was the first time we saw wheel cart. He sent two men to haul wood for the Indians, come all around, different tribes, and they make seats to have different tribes together. In the middle, he make a place for himself to preach and read the Bible on the table. He spoke through three interpreters for each tribe at that time while he was preaching. It seems to me the missionary spoke strong words when he opened the Bible to speak to the Indians. While he was preaching, the Indian chiefs sat smoking, not caring to hear the gospel. 3 or 4 days while he was preaching, all women and chiefs felt different, just like something melted and hot come down, and throw away their tomahawks and caps and war bonnets and fall down and ask God to forgive them. People were surprised to see what kind of spirit came down, and they look at each other and all see tears run down other faces, then all fall down and worship God. They used to feel all right, but found now they were not right inside. They would look at one another, and after a while,
excuse
they would
me.
Join the church. Oops. Oh, sorry. Yeah.
So, no, it's okay. If you want to submit that as written testimony,
yes.
We can make copies of that, and we will all read it. So I'm sorry to have to cut you short. We are just running late, but I want to thank you so much for coming and testifying.
Yes.
And again, if you want to submit that, we're happy, happy to read that. Please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, I'm Marilyn Shannon, and before I start, I just have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
None of us are paid lobbyists, but
right.
Why didn't the paid lobbyists have to face that? They took up all of our time.
We had other bills, and we had representatives, we had the treasurer, and then we had other bills. So for public testimony, we have a limited amount of time, and so I'm sorry.
And they were paid in their mileage. We all came on our own dollar.
I understand, and there's more of you, mm-hmm. So... Again, if you have two people and you give them 5 minutes and you have 17 people and you give them each 2.5 minutes, you still have more time for the 17
because
people.
Because I thought it was 30, I thought it was 5 minutes and it took, a minute.
Sure. And again, if you want to submit anything in writing, we promise to read it.
Now, come on.
I do. Everyone here is diligent. We actually do.
Come on. Okay. Madam Chair, my name is Marilyn Shannon. I want to start later in it, but anyway, Jason Lee was one of the first missionaries to go to Oregon to minister to the Indians. It wasn't long before he realized the Indian nations were a dying breed, and the opportunity was ripe for the United States to lay claim to this land of opportunity. Jason Lee walked and rode his horses to and from Washington, D.C. four times. Seeking statehood for Oregon. He raised money for his trips to and from D.C. from like-minded citizens he spoke to along the way. He was able to make a plan and successfully carry it out to secure Oregon for the U.S. instead of it going to Great Britain and Canada. Establishing the Oregon Territory did not establish statehood, but it did lead to statehood later on. Although four states have rotated out their original statues and replaced them with newer statues, it is not uncommon and very rare. California replaced theirs with Ronald Reagan. Michigan replaced theirs with Gerald Ford. Kansas replaced theirs with Dwight Eisenhower. And Alabama can replace theirs with Helen Keller. And I just want to say Mark Hatfield was a great man, and he's memorialized all over the state. My last comment is to remind everyone that it was possible to attend and graduate from college before Congress started infusing federal tax dollars into our colleges and universities. I know this because I did it, and I graduated cum laude. Neither of my parents finished high school, but I worked and graduated from college, the first in my family to graduate from college. And I didn't leave college owing $50,000 plus for my degree. The federal funding money that people are so happy with just increased astronomically the cost of a student's college and university education.
Thank you, Ms. Shannon. Okay. Janice Deisinger, Dolores McKee, and Lee Owens, S. Lee Owens.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Hoyle and Vice Chair Colby and members Can you hear me all right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. All right. I want to thank you for your time this afternoon. You hear a lot about Jason Lee's.
Oh, could you please identify yourself?
I'm sorry. I'm Janice Deisinger.
Thanks.
I'm from Gresham, Oregon.
Yeah.
There's so much rich heritage that we have with Jason Lee as our founding father. I really enjoyed looking at a lot of information online, both with the Oregon Historical Society, especially around the year 1906, when they went back and they were really looking at why Oregon was such a unique state, and they recognized at that time the importance impact that he had on our state, and they called it the seeds of greatness, and I had a reference in my testimony about that. Often we don't know our history as well as till we get back a ways from it and we can look at it. So I have a difference with just bringing in a lot of people to represent us at the Statuary Hall. When we had the perspective of the legacy of Jason Lee already there, why would we want to bring in a lot of different other people? We won't be showing the true heritage of our beginning. He not only had the spiritual effects on our state, but he had the foresight to bring in doctors and teachers and craftsmen to the area so that we became a civilization. That's why they called it the seeds of civilization that they were recognizing it. And the Methodist Church also brought his remains out at that time. So his life was really different. And there's a number of ways that we can recognize these other people. And I would encourage you to do that in a different way, as in putting maybe a statue of Mark Hatfield or other Oregonians over on the west side of the Capitol here. Thank you very much for your time. And I just ask you, I don't agree with this bill as far as starting a rotation, and it's not up for public discussion according to what I see here. It's just a task force that will be rotating. I don't agree with that at all.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Deisinger. Yes.
Hello, Madam Chairman and respected representatives. My name is Dolores McKee. I'm from Woodburn, Oregon. And my family are direct descendants from Jedediah Strong Smith. And so I'm honored today to represent this family. They went with Jason Lee much of the time when they were moving amongst the Nez Perce Indians. This is not common for me to do this. Hokus Deacon, the person on this, is a Native American who was influenced by Jedediah Strong Smith, who came with Jason Lee many times with a Bible in hand and a gun in the other. He was a trapper. Okay, so Hokus Deacon's farewell speech is, "We came to you over a trail of many moons from the setting sun. You were a friend of our fathers who have all gone the long way. We came with our eyes partly open for more light for our people who sit in the darkness. We go back with our eyes closed. How can we go back blind to our blind people? We made our way to you with strong arms." Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you so much. S. Lee Owens, Jerry Sutton, and Sigmund Wada?
Who ceded their time?
No, it's the women over here ceded their time. Are any of the three people I just called here?
Jerry, I conceded my time myself.
Oh, okay. Thank you. All right. Ronald Snyder, Mark Serra.
Mark stepped out for smoke.
Nicotine, it's more addictive than heroin.
It'll get you every time.
Yep.
My name is Ronald Snyder. I am from Eugene, Oregon. I'm a school teacher. I teach at a private academy called Logos Academy. And I teach math, social studies, and history. And early on, I began to become fascinated with Oregon's history and fascinated with what happened here in the Salem area and amongst the Indian tribes. And I came to appreciate with deep respect Jason Lee and his work. And I come here to say, as some of the others have, why would we disturb history when it's so well preserved? There are, as one person said, other avenues to honor. I have known about Mark Catfield for years and respected his work here in this state, but to make a statue and replace it in the rotunda of the Capitol Building. Now, also as a history teacher, I have spent a lot of time in Washington, D.C. I have made many trips. I have been in the rotunda off and on for 15 years. And one of the first things I did is I looked up Jason Lee and said, that's very interesting, and I appreciated him being there. And I would like, from a historic point of view, for him to remain there. As a teacher of history, I would like for that to remain that way. Thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
And thank you for your testimony. That's all I have signed up. I know that many of you came here because of your interest in the bill. Please email, send testimony, call your legislator. Those avenues are all open to you. We will not be voting on this bill today. It is simply a public hearing. So,
could I have, madam, just one more minute to close, since you can see there were several people that conceded that possibly it was, and had to lead to this less time. If we could take just one more minute.
I will give you 1 minute.
Okay.
And then, because we are 45 minutes over, and again, we all have other meetings that we're supposed to be at. But we wanted to stay because we value your word and your opinion, and that matters.
Thank you.
1 minute.
In this bill itself, declaring an emergency, see, I've been around the whole state of Oregon, all 36 counties, dressed up as Jason Lee. And the overwhelming response when people heard about our history, they were thrilled. They were like, how come I didn't know? Keep telling. Let's revive this. And the question when people find out declaring an emergency, I know what it means. It's a tag on the bill that can't refer it to the state for a vote. But if you look here, declaring an emergency for the immediate preservation of the public peace, health, and safety is declared. I mean, a statue is for the immediate preservation. This is, we need to truly have statesmanship here and the true authority. And the Oregon Historical Society, they're the so-called experts, but they need to be shamed in being a part to this, because it ought not be. So again, thank you for another minute. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 4171, and we are adjourned.